The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now, and of course, live in Technicolor on our YouTube channel on Vox Markets, Paul Hill, full-time investor, equity analyst, and interesting times, Paul, in the markets in NASDAQ. I don't know if you saw a chart there I posted on Twitter. NASDAQ, on what's called a relative strength index, hit 30. It hasn't done that since the Dash for Cash crash back in Feb, March. So the American markets having a bit of sell-off, but they do it, aren't they? They've been overvalued for a while, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, I think they're still sort of trading at ridiculously high value. I'd have to look at what the PE ratio of NASDAQ is, but the last time I saw it was well over 30 for the current year. S&P 500 is roughly around about 20, even though we've seen a sort of 5% correction. I think what has sort of particularly sort of perturbed investors is, it, first of all, first round of the sell-off, you've had all those really sort of high-flying no earnings and sort of like 50 times revenue type sales.
Kathy Woodstocks.
Yeah, Kathy Woods, yeah, Innovation Arc. So your CrowdStrikes, your, you know, basically Snowflakes and these kind of things went off quite a time ago. And then the market has been held up largely by the big FANG stocks. And then what you saw overnight as well, even Netflix came out with a bit of a bombed out statement, and its shares after the close fell 20%. So it does seem as though that's sort of crumpling, and the sentiment has certainly shifted, given that the bond yields on US treasuries have sort of like ticked up to, well, I think it was about 1.7, 1.8% when I last sort of saw it. So that's sort of like unnerving investors. But frankly, if you've actually invested in real businesses generating proper sort of cash flows, then in the long term, and if your time horizons are reasonably long, 3 to 5 years, you should be able to trade through this. So, and you've certainly enjoyed, as you rightly say, you know, a very strong 2020 on NASDAQ. 2021 was pretty good for the first sort of like 9 months as well. And it's really just been the last sort of five or six. And I would point investors now is that, given we've had a lot of sort of carnage there and we've been bringing out the bodies, there's some reasonable value now, actually. So people like me and GARP investors should be picking through the bones and looking for opportunities. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's funny. If you look at, like I said, you know, Netflix and even Peloton yesterday, you could say, I mean, Netflix is hugely successful. I think what they put in 2.5 million subscribers, under expected, but they were a bit of a, they had a boom, didn't they, during lockdown, especially Peloton. People couldn't go to the gyms. So the more well off people are paying over $2,000 for a bike, pretty much, with an iPad on it. You know? And now they're stopping production of their bikes and their treadmills because of the lack of demand. So that's actually fallen off a cliff. Yeah. Do you know what? I said exactly the same thing. I mean, I was in my ShareFix Investment Club chat forum. I said, you know, the futures are looking, the sell-off last night in America, but the futures are not looking very bright. I said, but don't panic, though. I mean, if you look at it, smaller micro-cap stocks have been in pretty much, you know, almost a bear market for like 6-8 months. Mm-hmm. I think, and they tend to, you know, sell ahead and rally faster. So and I said exactly the same thing. If you're in a good, improving business, think of the business. Don't look at the share price. Because if you invest, let's say you invest, a mate of yours is starting a new business, it's doing very well, he asked for investment, and you say, yeah, go for it, you know, and he's growing, say, revenue year on year, 20%, he's starting to get profitable, and then all of a sudden there's a correction in the US markets, you're not going to sell out your mate's business because of that. Now, the trouble is we're too focused on the share prices and, you know, other markets and what about contagion, but you've got to focus on the business because, like you said, time, it's a bump in the road. You know, 2-3 years time, you know, that business is still improving, will be worth a lot more. And that's all you can look at. You can't just, you know, as I said, predict the cycles of the market. But on the macro thing here, what's spooking people as well is you've got inflation, which is happening. It's almost self-correcting, isn't it, inflation?
It's not happening, Justin. It's rocketing.
It's here. Yeah, it's rocketing. It's happening. But it's self-correcting, is it? We see now people are starting to worry about prices going up. They're starting to tighten their little belts a bit. And so that hits, you know, retailers, whatever, or businesses. And then you've got the worry of Feds putting up interest rates to slow that down anyway. And you've got the bond buying. So part of me thinks, will the Fed, I mean, you know, when they last announced, I don't think people were as scared as they are now, and the stock market's selling off. Will the Fed, as they've done before, you know, the market tends to price in, you know, bigger worries and uncertainties than actually happens. Will they sort of pull back a little bit? In fact, we're not going to go as aggressive on the bond reduction buying and the interest rate hikes, because it's self-correcting already. You know, you can see it in the economy. It is happening, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the market is doing part of the heavy lifting for the Federal Reserve. You can see that because obviously with the market dropping, then it reduces that wealth effect and that stops people naturally buying. And therefore, you've got that sort of like... bit of ballast, bit of weight on top of inflation because people aren't sort of like paying crazy prices as they would do if they're feeling very flush with cash. You haven't seen that yet in the housing market. The housing market's still strong, but I do think you'll see a slowing down of that growth and even maybe even negative prices actually over the next sort of 2 years. And that's simply because there's more supply coming onto the market. You saw Rightmove, for instance, saying earlier in the week that it was seeing quite a lot of new sellers onto the market, which is great. And if you get that sort of supply demand, then it'll reduce that. So yes, I'm with you in terms of will the Federal Reserve have to do the 3 to 4 rate rises this year and perhaps another 2 or 3 next year? Well, the answer to that is actually that the market is already self-correcting, no doubt about it. But the problem you get then is that actually if you have just a modicum of sort of like rate rises and you have that end of the long end of the curve, the sort of 10-year treasury sort of like staying capped at about 1.8 sort of 1.9%, then you will see the flattening yield curve and potentially even a sort of like inverting of the yield curve, and then you get sort of recessionary conditions, and that'll have a negative feedback loop into sort of credit quality and into the banks, which have been very strong. So my take on it is that it's going to be a stock pickers market, as really it should have always been. And in the small cap space, it's been sort of like, you know, that particularly over the last sort of 6 months or so when you've had that sell-off. And I mean, I'm quite sort of like just lucky as much as anything, because I mean, as you know, I sold quite a few of my large cap positions before Christmas. So I've got a 30% share sort of like waiting into cash, and I'm looking forward to redeploy it. And that's a similar sort of strategy to Steve McQuillan, who you spoke to yesterday. Yeah. And I've been talking about Avingtraz as being a really good long-term sort of winner. It basically is a precision engineer that does sort of niche mission critical and safety parts in all kinds of different industries, but things like safety boxes and blast proof doors and pumps and valves for really challenging environments, etc. And it came out with inline trading update yesterday, as you know. But it's got an enormous cash mountain. It's got 22 million quid that, frankly, it's going to be redeploying. And they've been buying businesses really for the last 10 years very, very cleverly. And it's got two excellent sort of like, lots of really good shareholders, but sort of two I'd point to, Christopher Mills of Harwood, who's the biggest shareholder, I think, who obviously knows what he's doing. And then likewise is James Thorne of Columbia Threadneedle, and Simon Thompson of Investors Chronicle has been back in the stock. And you can see what, because it's done sort of like 20% per annum growth over the last sort of decade. And there's no reason why it can't do that, because it'll use some of its cash now to buy astutely. And I think what it also did, you tell me, but I think Steve probably also spoke to you about what they're looking for in that medical small form MRI scanner business they're doing. And they put a bit of investment also into another business, Adaptix, another, I think it was 1.5 million to buy another 6% stake or something, which does small form X-rays. And the idea is that you can get a lot of synergies between both their MRI business and the X-ray business to hopefully ultimately merge both images together to have this really sort of lead, small form, cheaper, sort of like, which does both skeletal images and detail and the soft tissue when people have sort of like, you know, they break their arm or wrist or something like that, and even maybe use it in some veterinary practice. So I don't know what your take was when you spoke to Steve.
Do you know what stood out? What stood out is that I did, of course, they're reliant on supply chains, you know, a lot of the time. And I said, how is it? Is it getting better? He said, it is getting better slowly. But what stood out to me is they're going to hit, you know, like I said, you know, in line, even with those problems. He said, now it's getting better slowly. He said, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's getting better slowly. So if they are actually, you know, hitting expectations with these issues, then you know, it's going to get better. So I'm assuming they can. Well, you did say that. I said, you know, if the supply chain's been easier to work with and hadn't been so locked up, and then we could have probably exceeded. But that's what we're working with, you know. So, like I said, that to me gives you confidence. You know, if they can actually hit expectations when they've got these global issues around the world, then once it starts easing, they're going to power away. And like I said, nice big cash pile there. In fact, you know what? Going back to property, very interesting. I had an email yesterday from a local estate agent, said they've never seen supply stock levels so low since they launched in 2003. And they said, the odd thing is, in the small town we're in, there's about 150 people on their books want to sell their house, but they're not putting their houses on the market because there's lack of choice there. And she said, so we've got this gridlock, you know, this catch-22 situation. He said, you know, amongst those 150 people, there may be people who want to buy each other's houses, but they're not putting them on the market. There's nothing there. But I don't know if you saw, on the market came out today, and they're quite bullish. They've done very well. They're going to, you know, as expected. In fact, revenue is going to be a little bit ahead of expectations. 2.5 million for the full year, they say, in operating profit. So they're looking bullish, but I think you're right. At the moment, with interest rates going up, you know, will house prices stay high? And I think it's going to break sooner or later. But on the
market, I think they'll readjust. They'll stay high, but they'll readjust, I think, is probably a better reflection. Maybe just not grow quite. They won't grow as fast, that's for sure. As you just get really just to balancing that supply and demand, because higher prices definitely will be a cure for sort of like higher prices in the housing market. But again, just coming back to, you know, your comment on Avacta with supply chain, the two reasons why they can nail their numbers, even where you've got supply chain problems worldwide, is twofold. One, because they're on long cycle sort of like industries and businesses, i.e. their visibility, their order book is fabulous, like HS2, for instance. Plus, a lot of their products, I mean, they're niche and they're mission critical, and people have got to buy them. It isn't as though you've basically got any choice, because you've got people's safety involved in this, you know, in these particular products. So, you know, when you've got regulatory drivers, secular tailwinds, and you've got strong niche positions in it, plus you've got great visibility, then you can ride out storms. And those are the kind of stocks you want. Really solid balance sheets, optionality in the healthcare business, and plenty of cash to redeploy. So
I tell you what you might like. I spoke to Nick Dashwood Brown from Anexo. He's the head of investor relations. I don't know if you have you ever heard of Anexo.
Yeah, they do. It's the car insurance.
Yes, specialist. Like, they're called specialist integrated credit hire and legal services provider. Essentially, if someone gets involved in a crash and their car's, it's no fault of their own, and their car's written off, their vehicle's written off, they supply credit to those, and they get the payment back from the person who caused the crash, of course. But I mean, they came out with an update ahead of market experts. In fact, significantly ahead of market expectations, and well, they have 135 million market cap. They did revenue 48 million for the half year. That's up 31%. Cash there 56 million. They're powering away, and so companies like that will not be affected by inflation or downturns. You know, that's going to happen. People crash every day, and so that's a stable business to get into. But very interesting, that worth a look. If you've got a bit of cash, you maybe look into that. But
I mean, I've been saying for some time that, you know, where am I going to deploy my sort of funds? And there's two sort of areas that I'm continually going to concentrate. It's technology, sort of software, etc., as you know, but particularly sort of healthcare as well. And I'm licking my chops at the moment. I mean, you've had four companies which have really sort of come down. I mean, let me just give you another one. You know, in the healthcare, they've got four of them here. Quickly go through. We've got Source Bio, who came out with a strong end to 2021, largely on the back of their infectious disease testing business, which is the COVID side, the PCR testing, instead of actually decelerating after the change in the tourist laws in October, actually, because of the Omicron, that they saw in, you know, pretty much very good growth, etc. And they can still need to see it in the new year, which gives them a better than expected outturn for 2021, a strong outlook into 2022, and an excellent sort of cash position. And I think they've got £33 million of cash to spend on sort of M&A. And I know Jay LeCue, the exec chairman, I mean, again, a really astute M&A guy. guy. Plus, it's obviously got Christopher Mills on the board, and they're gonna buy wisely, no doubt about it. And that's 44p per value share. But more importantly, their underlying business, which basically does genomic sequencing and cellular pathology and drug storage testing, etc. Given we've got the mountain of, you know, patient waiting lists, the 6 million elective procedures, and growing fast just in the NHS in England, they could have years and years of powerful growth on the back, strong double digit top line growth on the back of that. So for their base business, so I mean, I think they're well positioned going forward, and it's a good sort of healthcare stock. The shares aren't expensive either, around about £1.50, £1.60. So that's definitely one. And then another one I would say, which has sold off, you know, I know we've talked about and it is popular, is Avacta, because it came out with two pieces of news since we last spoke. First was a negative one that it decided, and this is it got battered for it actually, but it came, but basically, it did further testing on its sort of like rapid lateral flow test, and came out that actually it's the accuracy to detect Omicron wasn't quite as high as they wanted it to be, and therefore they took it off from being, you know, to be sold, etc. This sort of paused sales just while they sort of like reformulate the reagent and the Affimer that needs to identify it. And so they should have got a lot of credit for that. I mean, let's be clear about it. If they've got bad news, they didn't shy away from telling the market. I mean, they told people, they were straight up about it, and I think that's a good statement of the integrity and probity of the management, which I think is really poor. Sorry, is really important. And, you know, the shareholder reaction, or should we say the share price reaction, was pretty vitriolic, actually. So anyway, they came out with that. That was the negative side. But on the positive side, and far more significant and substantive, is that they've actually decided on a second lead candidate for their prodrug platform, the precision platform that does targeted chemo, sort of like warheads, etc. And the first one is already in phase 1 clinical trials. We hope to get sort of PK data out shortly. And to say to choose the second one, that implies to me, importantly, the first trial is going really well. They haven't actually released the data, so I don't know for definite, but I think you can probably infer that they wouldn't be announcing a second candidate unless the first one was actually going pretty well. So the first one is Prodoxorubicin. We'll see that one, which is about, I think it was about a $6 billion sort of like potential addressable market. And this one is it's basically a new drug, chemotherapy treatment that treats multiple melanoma, and obviously it's early days, etc. But the preclinical sort of testing and trial data has come out very positive, so we actually put it into clinical trials sort of the back end. I think it was 2023. They said second half of 2023, but that's really important. Another multiple billion dollar potential market, and if any of these sort of like shots on goal actually score, then it will just make a joke of the actual market valuation. So, I would tip my hat to the management team to sort of like, first of all, effectively bring out the bad news and withdraw the rapid lateral throat test. But also, this is great news in terms of the second candidate, because it's sort of like rubber stamps what they're currently seeing with their first candidate, which could be a real blockbuster. So anyway, we'll wait and see. But Avacta looks another one in terms of the sort of like the healthcare. And then Verici, who have actually had a lot of news flow recently. They've seen their share price get pretty much sold off as well. They said they gave a really update of where they looked, what they're hoping to do for 2022. And they've got a whole different series of things. And they hope to get sort of first data on their first two lead immunotherapy diagnostic tests for kidney transplant, which is one which is a prognostic. It's a pre-operation test, and the other one is a post-operation test, and they hope to get first sort of like validation of those or data in the end of March or something like that, and therefore then build out a full suite for all the sort of kidney transplant tests as well to have a later test as well. So that'll be great. That's really where that, you know, what they did for their IPO. But just as important, actually, which I hadn't really fully appreciated, and I don't think the market's recognised either, is that it puts a bit of significance into why they signed this deal with Illumina, which is the world's leading sequencing company. And the idea there is such that using that technology in a partnership, they're going to be able to mine their huge biobank of sort of like autoimmune signatures and profiles, a bit like Oncommune's Insights platform. And the idea is then is that you mine it and you actually put a layer of AI onto it. And you can then sell that data to help other companies, particularly in autoimmune, to improve their actual drug treatments and drug discovery, but also maybe to help some stratify sort of like patients when it comes to sort of clinical trials. So you've actually got another major potential revenue stream here. And it's data which has obviously come out of Mount Sinai, so it's world leading. And, that has totally not priced into the actual market. And, Oncommune's a £100 million plus market cap company. So this could be another significant value driver for the business if they get that. And as I say, the shares have just been sold off as the baby in the bathwater side of thing. And then the final one is Trellis, which came out with, again, as you know, increasing mountain of sort of clinical data, et cetera. They had a report which was peer reviewed, because they basically do resilience management for chronic diseases like Crohn's and colitis and inflammatory bowel disease. But what was really interesting, and again, I'm pretty much sure has been missed by the market, is that not only does that system and the technology, which is proprietary and patented, help people who have Crohn's and colitis to actually, you know, self-manage and to help those patients and sufferers, but also it improves sort of like it reduces the level of dependency of these sufferers on things like, you know, sort of like proper class A drugs, who, you know, they go to opioids or they go to steroids and stuff like that, because it helps them get through their condition. Because by having better resilience management, it means that they don't need to go onto those, or they don't, you know, abuse those particular treatments. So it has huge advantages elsewhere, and certainly gives support in terms of using that resilience management platform, their core platform, across multiple chronic diseases and different areas. So, again, the shares have fallen off, and I'd point all four of those stocks. You've got Source Bio, Avacta, Trellis, and Verici, all four of them.
Let me ask you a question there, because they're all five, you know, potentially excellent investments, but I think there's a big difference there. In so when you've got your cash now and you're looking for investment, what are you going for? More risk, an early stage commercialization? Because Source Bio, for example, they're commercialized their products already, and look at they got 115 million market cap, 33 million. So what, EV of what, 85? So their revenue less than 1x sales, and yet so it's a different, you know, Source Bio is different than the rest of them, but the rest may have a bigger upside potential. I mean, not those companies specifically, but where are you looking to deploy your cash? Is it going to be in a mixture, or are you going for a company that's, you know, generating a positive cash flow?
I typically like, obviously, you know, stuff that's post-commercialized, like it's generating revenues, et cetera. Mm. No doubt about it, because it gives you sort of like really a very good sort of, yeah, it'll give you better valuations, but also sort of rubber stamping the technology. But I would say the overriding factor is best in class technology. If the technology is so good that it's going to bring the world's best sort of like partners and clients and customers together, then that's really the leading leading decision maker when it comes to sort of like healthcare. And then you have to sort of like, you know, price that into the actual, you know, to the share, into the risk equation and the valuation upside about which stage of development. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there's lots and lots of I think the healthcare is a fantastic area, and I need to do more work on that whole sector to decide where I'm going to redeploy. But that's definitely, as I say, all five of those look well sold off, and you know, they're good opportunities longer term. So, yeah.
Have you got any in the sights? I mean, are you close to putting?
Yeah, I've got those five in my sights.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Monitoring them like a. But let's be clear about it. I don't need to rush into these things. Yeah. I don't see there's going to be a massive bounce in, you know, the Nasdaq and, you know, sort of like all the indices and sentiments in the short term. So I'm just going to take my time and on the tech side, because I think there's lots of good opportunities in, you know, in tech as well.
I've always, whenever I've, you know, made investment, I found my biggest mistake is rushing in too quickly. You know, there's always a rush in, chuck a load in, then all of a sudden it sells off again. Oh my God, I've just, you know, gone a bit slower on this. That's always the, when you get enthusiastic about doing some research in a company, you get really, oh, you can see the upside of potential is. Yeah, I've always moved too fast generally, and more patience is always needed. But do you know what's funny about when you look at valuations and share prices? When you look at valuation, you tend to get more excited when their share price comes down. If you just focus on share price, and it's worry. It's like, so valuations are always worth looking at, aren't they, rather than compared to share prices, you know? And like I said, you're looking at opportunities now. I wish I had more cash now. I'm thinking, God, there are some things around I'd like to buy, but I don't. But that's the way it is, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, another one, you know, I own actually, which came out, was unbelievably good. Trading update for the year end is Equals.
Realize you were Equals.
Well, that's been one of the reasons, actually, has helped my portfolio has been fairly resilient in the first quarter, you know, single-handedly sort of all the, done the heavy lifting on it.
It helps to have one, even if the market's down, isn't it? If you have one that's performing, it really helps, doesn't it? Just your sentiment and your valuation of your portfolio, but it helps you be more positive, you know?
Well, I mean, it isn't really, I mean, I don't take any credit for it. I mean, I'd put it all down. I mean, the management team has just done an absolutely fabulous job, both of them, you know, sort of Ian Stratford Taylor, the CEO, and the CFO, Richard Cooper. I mean, you know, they've come out with sort of like-for-like results of nearly double what they in Q4, what they were in the preceding year. And Q4 had just gone. I mean, Q3 was a massive sequential improvement on Q2 last year. And Q4 was up another 28% on Q3. And if you strip out sort of like even their one-off Forex transaction, you still get over 70% like-for-like growth year on year. And they're doing a run rate of over £1 million per week. And my modest expectations are, I think, for around about £52.5 million for sales and EBITDA of about £8 million, because they're reinvesting a lot of their money, extra money they're making, into further growth for 2022. And you should really see that one then come through in 2023. And, you know, let's be clear about it. Other people now are starting to realize that actually there's a really strong underlying growth story here, and high operating leverage. So you've had a few fund managers now buying
in. Yes, Schroeder's getting there, and who else is there?
I think that's Columbia Threadneedle. I mean, it looks
like Mary Prize.
But if you actually look further down the RNS, I think it's Columbia Thread. It's Threadneedle, but I think it's James Thorne there. But you've got
one offloading, haven't you? One amber, the amber crystal amber fund. They're offloading, but two others sort of buying up. So
But you've also got other very good fund managers who are in there, but don't have 3% stakes. For instance, I spoke to Judith McKenzie at Downing, and she likes the stock and believes this 80% upside. That was from sort of 70p. So she, if you put the numbers through, that, you know, she's looking at sort of like a £1.20, £1.25, you know, share price. And that was before their trading update. And I'm on about, I'm on 128 or 125. So, you know, you can see how you can get there. And again, I would just say, you know, I've got quite a few shares, as you know, and I'm just happy to hold because the business is flying. The management team's doing a great job and customers are loving the platform. You just got to look at the actual numbers, etc. But that's, you know, really heavy. That's a lovely combination of, you know, sort of like long-term secular tailwinds in terms of moving to sort of digital payments, etc., and Forex. And plus, obviously, you know, the banking sector, you know, sort of like with higher yields, the financials should do well. So it should be a multiple winner. But there will be bumps along the road. You know, things will never move up in straight lines. And, you know, let's see how they get on. But as I've said before, you know, I said to you at the start of at the end of 2020, my best tip was going to be, or best my recommendation was going to be Equals, when I think it was about 25p, 30p. And it did very well. But I could still see it do, as I've said, in the last year, I think it still could do very well. So, you know, I'm sticking with it. And likewise, with the Northbridge, they came out with a good sort of like trading update. Nothing major, but they just said, you know, they expect more news in terms of, you know, the proposed or forthcoming Tasman disposal to be released in February. And importantly, or far more value, importantly, is the Creswick load banks is doing very well indeed. And it's sort of like, you know, the performance and the demand there is strong. Shares haven't moved. They're around about 170. And I know why, because, you know, Christopher Mills at Harwood Capital has been buying more and more. And I think he's probably now the number one shareholder. And as I say, that was another one I mentioned to you at about sort of like 80, 90p. And it's 170 now. But I could, you know, my fair value is well over £2, and you know, Simon Thompson at Investors Chronicle likes it. Obviously obviously Christopher Mills likes it as well. But that Creswick business is fabulous. You know, it's absolutely a world class sort of like play on, you know, sort of the network resilience, and then obviously secular growth and things like, you know, data centers, you know, battery farms and all this sort of stuff. And it will just do carry on growing. And once they get, I mean, the important bit is once they get that new capacity on board at their factory in Burton-on-Trent, up by about 50% mid of this year, you'll really see that drive profits in 2023. And when that happens in 18 months' time, I think the shares will be over £3, but I mean, it's all speculation. I don't know where they will. But again, two stocks that I think actually going to do pretty well, and the management team are doing a fabulous job. You know,
yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? You know, if you look back all the time, it's funny at the moment, there's a lot of sort of fear and negativity in the markets, but everyone's worried about inflation, you know, going way up. I mean, it's high at the moment, but if you look back, the best times to buy, you know, generally invest in companies is when the fear is high, isn't it? You know, and that's one of the psychologies of the market that people don't ever understand. They give you more worries and more worries. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. You've got to figure in, okay, how will this affect the business I'm invested in? You know, specifically in the business I'm invested in, how will it affect it? That's all you've got to bring it down to, isn't it? Someone just getting worried, you know, generally about everything in the world. You've got to look at how it affects your business, haven't you, I suppose? And that's all it plays out to.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, two others that I haven't bought into, but I'm certainly looking at, and one's in sort of like healthcare or near healthcare is, and I spoke to you before Christmas, and I should have really sort of like grasped the nettle then, because the shares were about 25p. They're about just over 40p. Is Venture Life, okay? And I said this was a fallen, I thought this was a fallen angel, but I wanted to speak to the CEO, Jerry Randall, beforehand, which I now have done, actually. And I mean, they're a collection. They're basically a collection of OTC consumer healthcare products that have strong niche positions. And when I discussed it with him on an interview, and I suggest investors have a good look at it, he reckons that though that base business is going to grow at about organically sort of 10% per annum, and then you're going to get extra lift as well in terms of sort of, you know, M&A going forward. But it's a marker for valuation. Unilever, as you probably know, put a bid out for GlaxoSmithKline's OTC healthcare business, which is really largely toothpaste, etc. Not as niche as the, you know, basically as Venture Life's. And they're paying, well, they were proposing to pay 20 times EBITDA for it. Now, Venture Life, as a, you know, an aggregate portfolio of OTC brands, is worth, well, it's priced at the moment less than 8 times EBITDA. In fact, it's probably now about closer to 7 times EBITDA. So there's significant value upside. And the reason for that is twofold. One, because you've had a baby in the bathwater in terms of, you know, the stocks have sold off, but also there's a bit of, you know, there's still a bit of sort of like health that the business needs to do in terms of it's been hit by supply chain issues and COVID and also destocking. But one of the news that was released 2 weeks ago was such that it just swapped out its Chinese distributor, which had been underperforming, and now it's got a new partner that actually should do a lot of that sort of heavy lifting and do well and turn that business around. And it's only, and I think most of the other issues will be ironed out over, you know, 2022. So this is definitely another stock to has got significant upside at current levels, around about 45p, I think. But if you just put an overlay, so like you look through it and look at Singer's numbers of 8x EBITDA for this year, if you overlay sort of 10 to 15x EBITDA multiple on this on the group, then you get anywhere between sort of 90p and 130. So there's significant upside. And I did see one of their other brokers has got a upside target. I think it's about 125. And I know Simon Thompson's got a buy rating on it to about a pound compared to 45p. So there is significant upside. And it's another one which looks ridiculously cheap, to be perfectly honest, in sort of like, you know, healthcare and brands where you have strong niche positions and importantly pricing power. So that's sort of like another one to sort of like, you know, to slide, to have a look over.
Yeah, it's not that Unilever deal, wasn't it, where, you know, yeah, 50 billion, just going, you know, you're not valuing it correctly. I thought, what? That's a minute. But even so Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard, yeah, they paid about 18x EBITDA, biggest deal ever. 68 billion for Activision. You
think dollars, wow. Yeah,
that's nuts, isn't it? But I mean, you know, you understand why they're doing it, because, you know, we've got in our house one of those passes, the Microsoft, you know, Xbox passes, and it's just having that, you know, if you're going to buy into a system, it's like Netflix, isn't it? If you're going to buy into something on subscription, you want content to be there, and the best content like Call of Duty and all that stuff will be there. So, but gaming, it's not getting any smaller. You know, it's getting better. The game's getting better. There's more people playing them. Now you could even be professional gamers. There's lots of money, you know, for professional gamers. So, I like the gaming space.
What's important there is, again, take a step back and look big picture. That says to me, you know, people in the industry, really astute investors, because they're obviously, you know, a trade investors, Microsoft, are buying on the dip there, because actually Activision shares fell about 35%, 35%, and they're taking this wobble in the stock market to buy up for strategic stakes. So again, people can take, you know, this is selectively buying the dip on tech weakness, on healthcare weakness, is actually not a stupid strategy. You know, you've got to be, don't throw your money everywhere, but definitely pick through what's fallen hard and what you really want to go for, because that's exactly what Microsoft have just done, and just prove the principle.
And what's your thoughts on this year? Because we're going back last year, we say come 2022, I think it'll be a cracking year. And I still think that towards the end of the year, I think a lot of the uncertainty, maybe inflation will come down and all that stuff a little bit, you know, as supply chains ease and people stop spending a little bit. And I don't think policy, central banks will be as aggressive. And I think we'll rally a little bit. But at the moment, it's not looking like that. What's your thoughts for the rest of the year?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually. I heard a term by I think it was a merchant banker, BMO, which I had never heard before, but I thought it was quite appropriate. He said, forget about bulls and bears for this year. Think about buffaloes. And I said, what? What's he talking about here? Well, then he tried to explain it. He said, basically, a buffalo is still a part of the bull sort of
family,
but basically sort of wanders a bit on the prairie and can go up and can go down, but it still should overall move in the right positive direction. And he's expecting a sort of 7 to 10%, you know, sort of like by the end of the year sort of gain. But he does see, I think most people are expecting, whilst the Fed sort of like unveils its tightening, it's got two parts to the sort of like, you know, its strategy, the Fed, one to push up interest rates, but two to then, you know, to finish off the tapering, which I think is all about, will be done and dusted by March, but then may well also add on a bit of quantitative tightening to it. And that's the, once the uncertainty of that, what they're going to do, has been lifted, then I suspect you'll start to see more positive equity gains. So that will be around about sort of Q2, which is why people are expecting sort of like volatility to go, you know, to carry on, because you are going to see, as they reduce the liquidity, given that we've got lots of people effectively still betting on the market, if that liquidity is withdrawn, the money that they're using, the margin that they use, will have to be actually absorbed elsewhere or taken elsewhere, and that's going to lead to distressed selling. So you will get these effectively quite a few continued dislocations throughout it, not in the perhaps the biggest, but you might see some of the really big stocks, the FANG stocks, being used as ATMs to actually pay some of the margin calls, you know, yeah, that people are going to go to. So coming back to the original question, I'm still like you, I'm still relatively positive, but I do think, and we would stress, it's stock pickers marking and choose companies and businesses that have pricing power, because I've got a sneak suspicion inflation is still going to be sticky for, as we've both said, yeah, for longer than people
well,
expect.
Well, it's not going to drop overnight, is it? But no. Yeah, and it is funny. Look at growth and value. You know, value is important. It provides a downside there, protection, and growth gives you upside. Yeah, absolutely.
Another one I would say in terms of, you know, if you're looking for sort of like companies, go for best in class. You know, mm-hmm, I've talked about best in class in healthcare, where you go for the sort of like best of breed technology. But also, if you want to go for sort of like, you know, more consumer related, which is a really bombed out sector, then, you know, look at online, because obviously that's secular, you know, trends, etc., we should continue. And also just look at the ones which are performing well. And I'd point, you know, another one is Marks Electrical, which came out with a trading update a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, when I spoke to the guys, and they delivered like-for-like growth over the Christmas period in Q3 of 27%. And they do all things sort of like, you know, domestic appliances like fridges, freezers, cookers, TVs and stuff like that. And he's run by an entrepreneur, Mark Smithson, who, and Joss Egan, the CFO, who are doing an absolutely great job. But that, when you put it into the context, that 20% like-for-like growth is against tough comparisons from, you know, 2020. So that's really, you know, good. But when you also put it into the context of the electricals market in the UK dropped by 10% over Christmas, and you had the number one player, Currys, coming out with a 6% drop, and we haven't seen AO World, what they're going to come out, but that could be sort of negative 10%. You then realise that they are not only best in class, they are knocking the ball out of the park. And they have a market share currently around about 1.5%. But Mark, the CEO, you know, the founder, he's actually a, you know, born entrepreneur. He wants to get that over the next 5 years or so to sort of 10%. And if they do that, then the share's easily valued over £6. And even if you look at it sort of like 4% market share, you get sort of £2.50 from the current price of about £1.15. So again, if you're looking for sort of like, you know, really bombed out sector, like in consumer, go online, and these guys are 100% online, and go for best in class. And these guys, they're just trouncing anybody else. Yeah.
It's a difference between like a national brand who's run by managers and have KPIs, and a family business created by the founder with pride in the business, you know, and really knocking it out of the park. And like I say, even their Trustpilot rating's gone up from 4.7 to 4.8.
I mean, how'd you get a Trustpilot rating at 4.8? I've never seen that so high.
But you are serving thousands of customers. You always get some people unhappy about anything. Mm. Anything, you know, it's nothing to do with the company. They'll always whinge about something. So, yeah, it's amazing to score that, isn't it?
Mm. And I think... I mean, coming back, here's a question for you. What we've got at the moment.
Is it easy?
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a general sort of investing principle as much as anything. Yeah, we've gone through, you know, I've talked about sort of like, you know, I'm looking for sort of stocks, mainly in tech and healthcare and software and stuff like that. But when you do get sort of like a drop in the market, okay, it has two effects. One, it can, as we talked about, dislocation. So you've got to basically have a list of companies, you know, stocks to watch, and those are the ones you're going to pick rather than picking anything. But the other thing which you also get is a few blow-ups, because I think Warren Buffett says it, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. And you could get, because what you get is some companies basically who have been effectively, you know, stretched balance sheets and all this sort of stuff. So you've got to be very careful about which ones. And the question I'll ask you, you know, is really when it comes to sort of like deciding which companies are really sort of like, you know, because most people, you know, which companies are guilty until they're proven innocent. And I think that's a key one, because you've got to be, even if they come off a lot, you've got to be careful that are you buying a value trap? And I mean, how do you go about assessing?
Well, generally, with the space I look in, I mean, generally, most companies do not have debt because they've just started generating revenue and stuff, and they use equity to get there. But I always, you know, I have a filter systems I go through is the acronym is schedules. Within that is the earnings. I mean, I've got to look for growth and valuation, but also cash. And if you are investing in new companies, I say, do they have enough cash to get a profitability? You know, if not, they're going to come back to the market, or if, you know, they take a downturn, will they have to, you know, go by debt? So yeah, I always check the balance sheet. It's like anything. Businesses again. If you're going to buy a business from someone, so let's say you go to the road and you're going to buy a restaurant or you're going to buy a hairdresser or something, you want to know if that company's got debt, you know, and is up to eyeball in debt, you know, or have they got a decent amount of cash? But I always look at companies, you know, with a path to profitability. So I invest in newish companies that are on the turn. But do they have a pathway to profitability? Can they get there on their existing cash resources? And I generally say, avoid debt. If it's a little bit of debt, fine. But in smaller microcaps, you don't need to take on companies with debt. There's plenty of other opportunities out there. So if you're worried about the debt, just move on. Go to the next company, do some research. So yeah, that's always the worry. Cash flow is the lifeblood, isn't it? Of any company, if they can't get access to it or don't have it, then it's a big risk. It's a massive risk. So look elsewhere. There's plenty of opportunities out there without taking on a company with distressed levels of debt and stuff like that. So yeah.
Well, the debt's a relatively easy thing to see, unless the accounts are absolutely sort of fraudulent, etc. But how do you assess the management team? That's the more important one. Is it that, you know, they talk a good story, etc. But frankly, when it comes to actually,
but that's why I used to invest in sort of pre-revenue companies. I've moved away from that a little bit because I just think it's a little bit of a risk and you can't tell. To me, revenue growth, as long as they haven't been overly spending on marketing somewhere, but revenue, I used to look for, you know, growing, improving, you know, reasonably valued companies. So growing is top line pretty much. That says the product has validation, there's demand for it, there's people buying it. If they're growing, say, 20% year on year, of course, COVID may keep a close track on some companies because COVID may have knocked them this year or last year. But 20% year on year growth revenue-wise, are they improving that in margins? If you look at their margins are improving. That means they're not paying for that revenue growth through the nose somewhere. It's efficient. And then, of course, evaluation. I look at it. And you've helped me a lot with valuations because, I mean, you are the spreadsheet guy and you look at I look at companies, depending what sector they're in, of course, but I try and get companies, you know, within 3x, you know, EV sales, anything more than that. I don't want to look 10 times as nosebleed material, but if they're in hot areas, it may go for 5x, but less than that, 3x or less. So growth, value, and, you know, got to be improving as well, you know, and hopefully in a hot area. How else do you judge whether a company is improving unless its revenue is growing and its margins improving? If they're not pre-revenue, it's very hard because they're very much a story stock then, and you can believe they're improving. But are they improving? You know, what are you judging them on? So, to me, it's you have to look at the financial metrics. You know,
that's the least difficult part. What I was going to say was, how do you assess the capability of the management team and whether you can trust them? Whether they're going to be are they going to stay in that guilty until proven innocent basis, or as we normally do, is the other way around?
I do red flag system with that. I mean, literally, if they come up with something that's not on plan, like for example, I give a cracking example that was Salt Lake Potash. It went bust, right? I got it way before.
Did it? Went bust?
Yeah,
did
yeah.
it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. De-listened.
I remember you talked about me about, yeah, yeah, about 2 years ago.
The potential there was very big, and they had a scalable project. You know, now they said they were fully funded to get a production. So that was why I liked them. You know, they were fully funded. Their production was huge. They could be 10, 20 bagger if they put all the lakes on site. And then all of a sudden they did a fundraise. I thought, hang on a sec, what's going on here? That's a red flag. They said, and then because they said, the timelines have slipped and all that stuff. And so to me, that's one red flag. Another one, I'm out. Full stop. I don't care what there is. There's other opportunities out there. Then, and this is pre-revenue, of course, this company, they raised the game because they couldn't get the debt over the line. So I was out straight away. Then without a question of doubt, I was out. No excuses. I'm not going to give the management another chance. I don't have to. There's other companies out there. There's thousands of listed companies. If a company gets 2 red flags, I'm out. That's it, you know?
So basically, if they say what they're going to do and then they do something totally opposite, then
they give them once because there can be external factors that can hit the business. If they do it a second time, No, that's not, that's them. It's not the business, or it's not macro factors. So yeah, I'll give, and maybe macro factors, but I'll take a back seat and monitor it while it goes on, because I'm not giving you a second chance, you know, with my money. Full stop.
I like that. That's good. I like the double red flag. Yeah, two right, straight out. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's as good as any. Yeah, it's good, as good as any. I mean, I would also say, point, you know, investors have a look at sort of the, you know, the corporate governance side. Who are the other directors, for instance? Who are the large shareholders? If you've got some really good sort of like, you know, frontline shareholders on board on the register, then that gives people a lot of confidence that people know what they're doing, is in terms of that they trust all the numbers and what's the guidance and the strategy and stuff like that. So, and particularly when companies do go through some problem areas, if they're active investors, then they're going to help and do some of the heavy lifting when it comes to sort of like turning the business round. So, it's the hardest part of investing.
Yeah, well, one of the filters is looking at board of management, skin in game, all that stuff. I look at that, you know, because if your CEO is a decent chunk of
skin in game. How much they pay themselves.
Yeah, all that. Yeah, yeah. But there are people who held on to SO4 until it went bust, hoping that, well, they'll just get, let them just get production. But I thought, well, they didn't get a production in the end because they've broken the rules twice, and that's it. I mean, if you still like the company, just get out. Take a back seat and see if they actually get the production, because there's always opportunities to get back in. But once you're in, it goes bust. That's it. You know, you can't. So, yeah.
And also bringing out bad news when you don't need, you know, you don't need to. In fact, that, you know, in terms of, you know, that's something which, you know, Avacta have done, and they got mullered for it. So, you know, but that just shows the integrity of the sort of the, you know, the directors and the business going forward, and really holds it in good stead.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Cheers for that, Paul. And we'll catch up in 2 weeks, fella.
Yeah. Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.